Blog Talk Radio.
What you're fixing to witness now is the man who came by to get King to take him to dinner. And 30 years later at a press conference, he slipped, because God do baffle your mind sometimes. You look,
geared especially for the young who did not have a chance to get to feel or to know what the civil rights movement actually was about. Even as they marched, now they could have stopped in a hotel, but when you think about marching from Memphis to Jackson or Jackson to Memphis, that went a hotel. You stayed in churches, you stayed in people's homes, and that's how we got over, that's how we got through. The struggle was a spiritual struggle. You couldn't pay people to do what we had to do. You couldn't pay people to stand before mad dogs and fire hoses and billy clubs and cattle prods. It was strictly a spiritual and moral movement. So we wanted that dimension to be in the pilgrimage to Memphis. We will revisit the mountaintop speech site. That's the Mason's Temple, where Dr. King made his last address, which he almost didn't make, because the night that we were having that rally, there were tornado warnings, and he was behind on the Poor People's Campaign. And he said, "You guys go on over and have the rally. I'm going to stay at the motel and work on the Poor People's Campaign." When we got there, and Dr. Abernathy walked in, and Jesse Jackson walked in, and I walked in, and others, people started clapping because they thought Martin was behind us. And so Ralph's preacher sense said to him, "This is not our crowd." And he went to the phone and called Dr. King. And any of the marches that we had in those days, you have an opportunity to bring the children and bring the family and march with us. And when I finished sharing with them the last hour of Dr. King's life, a hurry. But that gave me the wonderful privilege of spending the last hour on earth. Three preachers in a room. Abernathy, King, and Kyle. And we spent that last hour together in room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. The press is always curious, and writers, "What went on? What did you talk about?" I say, "We just talk preacher talk. What preachers talk about when they get together."
Y'all pay real attention to what you're fixing to hear now.
About a quarter of six, we walked on the balcony, and he was talking to people in the courtyard. He stood here and I stood there. Only as I moved away so we could have a clear shot, the shot rang out.
Thank you.
I turned around and then knocked him back on the balcony.
Listen.
Oh.
Wait, listen.
His brother never realized he would slip and say that.
Greetings, everybody. Thank you guys for tuning in to Enhancing Awareness Radio. I am your host, Haru, and I just want to kind of quickly jump on here. I was supposed to do this broadcast last night, and I do apologize. Yesterday was the day that, the world pretty much celebrates Martin Luther King, but his birthday was actually last week. So, when it comes to Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, there's a lot of conspiracies on how, he was kind of into other things, I don't know. I've only done so much research on Dr. King, but what I will say is this, when it comes to the heart of compassion, I feel that Dr. King did have a very great heart you know, when it comes to compassion and when it comes to the people behind anything that he probably was ever involved in. I feel that he had a compassionate heart at the end of it all, you know, and I feel that he truly was for the people. So what we like to do here at Enhancing Awareness Radio is that we like to pretty much kind of, you know, give you a insight onto things that may not be kind of on the mass scale as far as awareness is concerned, because we know how the media pretty much lies to us and, you know, not really tell us all the truth. So that clip was from a preacher, you know, that years ago, and, you know, he was pretty much talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King. But at the end of the clip, you guys, you did, I hope you guys heard it at the end of the clip where, you know, he said as he moved away so they can have a clear shot. You know what I'm saying? So the so that tells me that the people, you know, that were in his company, you know what I mean, pretty much kind of knew, you know, my point is that rabbit hole is deeper than what it always appears to be. All right. So if anyone of you guys want to know, you know, some more detailed insight on Dr. Martin Luther King, I encourage you to do your research. I believe that the clip on YouTube is entitled Dick Gregory, Pastor Tells the Truth About King Assassination, somewhere on the lines. I believe the pastor name is Billy. I can't think of the last name, but from that information alone right there, you should have enough to kind of go off on so you can do your own research, all right? So I kind of wanted to just breeze through real quick. You know, I mean, I'm not going to be doing much talking on this show. I'm just going to play the clip. Because Dr. Martin Luther King, not only did he do the, the dream speech, right? You know, that's all we know about King. You know, that's all the school taught us. That's all we know, you know, as far as repetition learning, you know, is the I dream, you know, the dream speech. And, I mean, Martin Luther King actually had more insight. And what I'm going to play for you today is a great speech that I stumbled up on, you know, when he, I stumbled up on this in my research, you know, when it comes to the Dr. King assassination. You know, it's some great stuff out there, guys. You know, there are many theories, you know, that this was a CIA assassination hit. You know what I mean? And also, if you do your research as well, you will find that the King family actually got a lawsuit, you know, in regards to the murder, okay? Let's be clear, the murder assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, all right? So what I'm going to play again for you today is a speech that I stumbled up on, a wonderful speech, and he talked about the other America, right? So we're living in America. We think, you know, the American dream, you know, we think of whatever, but what is the other America? So we all know in this spirituality level 506 that there are realities within realities, worlds within worlds within worlds. So when it comes to America, what is the other America? So I'm going to go ahead and let Dr. King explain to you about the other America. So just take a listen to it, and you'll kind of be like, the other America, okay. So anyway, guys, I just wanted to honor King, you know, and just really not just telling the half of the story, but, you know, King knew more, you know what I mean? And he talked about more when it, you know, versus the movement of, you know, segregation and all of that. You know what I mean? He talked more in depth, you guys, and this is one of them, The Other America. This clip is about 48 minutes long, so I will play the clip. I will possibly come back in. If not, I'll just, you know, kind of leave you with that. All right, peace and love, family, and I appreciate you. So let me go ahead and pull up this clip for you. There we go, guys. All right, and I will possibly be back. All right, if not, please join us tonight for a discussion in the Black Room. They're going to be doing another broadcast tonight at 7:30 Eastern, 6:30 Central. So please be sure that you're there for that. All right, guys.
Dean LaPierre, Mr. Bell, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen. Now, there are several things that one could talk about before such a large, concerned, and enlightened audience. There are so many problems facing our nation and our world that one could just take off anywhere. But today I would like to talk mainly about the race problem, since I'll have to rush right out and go to New York to talk about Vietnam tomorrow, and I've been talking about it a great deal this week and weeks before that. But I'd like to use as a subject from which to speak this afternoon the other America. And I use this subject because there are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for a situation. And in a sense, this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds, and freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. This other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In a sense, the greatest tragedy of this other America is what it does to little children. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental skies. And as we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are Appalachian whites. Probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size in the population is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto is to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now let me say that the struggle for civil rights and the struggle to make these two Americas one America is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade or maybe 12 years, we struggled all across the South in glorious struggles to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodations. Public transportation was segregated, and often we had to sit in the back, and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. And the struggle was to deal with these problems. Now, certainly they were difficult problems. They were humiliating conditions. By the thousands, we protested these conditions. We made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. In 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma movement in 1965, we were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides, but we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. And so today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. It's not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago, And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, but Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. And as we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. And so they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. And that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. And among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. And so you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now, the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us didn't see too well during the last 10 years, that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flow of history, and the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved, innately impure, and innately inferior. In the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. And he ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. And this is the tragedy of racism, because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, if one says that I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. And this is the great tragedy of it. I say that however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America. It's still deeply rooted in the North, and it's still deeply rooted in the South. Now, this leads me to say something about another discussion that we hear a great deal, and that is the so-called white backlash. I would like to honestly say to you that the white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon. Not something that just came into being because shouts of black power, or because Negroes engaged in riots in Watts, for instance. The fact is that the state of California voted a fair housing bill out of existence before anybody shouted black power, or before anybody rioted in Watts. It may well be that shouts of black power and riots in Watts and the Harlems and the other areas are the consequences of the white backlash rather than the cause of them. What it is necessary to see is that there has never been a single solid monistic determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans. The whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. This is something that truth impels all men of goodwill to admit. It is said on the Statue of Liberty that America is the home of exiles. But it doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the home of its white exiles from Europe. But it has not evinced the same kind of maternal care and concern for its black exiles from Africa. And it is no wonder that in one of his sorrow songs, a Negro could sing out, "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child." What great estrangement, what great sense of rejection caused the people to emerge with such a metaphor as they looked over their lives. What I'm trying to get across is that our nation has constantly taken a positive step forward on the question of racial justice and racial equality. But over and over again, at the same time, it made certain backward steps. And this has been the persistence of the so-called white backlash. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery. But at the same time, the nation refused to give him land to make that freedom meaningful. And at that same period, America was giving millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that America was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor that would make it possible to grow and develop. And refused to give that economic floor to its black peasant, so to speak. And this is why Frederick Douglass could say that emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger, freedom to the winds and rains of heaven, freedom without roofs to cover their heads. He went on to say that it was freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine at the same time. But it does not stop there. In 1875, the nation passed a civil rights bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed a weaker civil rights bill. And even to this day, that bill has not been totally enforced in all of its dimensions. The nation heralded a new day of concern for the poor, for the poverty-stricken, for the disadvantaged, and brought into being a poverty bill. But at the same time, it put such little money into the program that it was hardly and still remains hardly a good skirmish against poverty. White politicians in suburbs talk eloquently against open housing and in the same breath contend that they are not racist. Now all of this and all of these things tell us that America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negroes and other disadvantaged groups for more than 300 years. So these conditions, persistence of widespread poverty, of slums, and of tragic conditions in schools and other areas of life, all of these things have brought about a great deal of despair and a great deal of desperation, a great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro communities. Today, all of our cities confront huge problems. All of our cities are potentially powder kegs as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger, many in moments of deep bitterness, engage in riots. Let me say, as I've always said, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. That in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. So I will continue to condemn riots and continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as America postpones justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. social justice, and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention. Now let me go on to say that if we are to deal with all of the problems that I've talked about, that we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America in order to deal with the problems that I have mentioned. Now, in order to develop these massive action programs, we've got to get rid of one or two false notions that continue to exist in our society. One is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. I'm sure you've heard this idea. It is the notion almost that is something in the very flow of time that will miraculously cure all evils. And I've heard this over and over again. There are those, and they're often sincere people, who say to Negroes and their allies in the white community that we should slow up and just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years the problem will work itself out, because only time can solve the problem. I think that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme rightists in our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. Comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so we must help time, and we must realize that the time is always right to do right. Now, there's another notion that gets out. It's around everywhere. It's in the South, it's in the North, it's in California and all over our nation. It's a notion that legislation can't solve the problem, it can't do anything in this area. And those who project this argument contend that you've got to change the heart, and that you can't change the heart through legislation. Now, I would be the first one to say that there is real need for a lot of heart changing in our country, and I believe in changing the heart. I preach about it. I believe in the need for conversion in many instances, and regeneration, to use theological terms. And I would be the first to say that if the race problem in America is to be solved, the white person must treat the Negro right. Not merely because the law says it, but because it's natural, because it's right, and because the Negro is his brother. And so I realize that if we are to have a truly integrated society, men and women will have to rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. But after saying this, let me say another thing which gives the other side, and that is that although it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, behavior can be regulated. The heartless, even
All right. Peace, family.
I'm convinced that we still need strong civil rights legislation. There's a bill before Congress right now to have a national, federal open housing bill. Federal law declaring discrimination in housing unconstitutional. And also a bill to make the administration of justice real all over our country. Now, nobody can doubt the need for this. Nobody can doubt the need if he thinks about the fact that since 1963, some 58 Negroes and white civil rights workers have been brutally murdered in the state of Mississippi alone. Not a single person has
Peace. Welcome back to Enhancing Awareness Radio. This is your host, Haru. I hope you guys enjoyed that. You know, I just wanted to kind of put a little spin on, we're so used to hearing the I Have a Dream speech, you know what I mean, when it comes to Dr. Martin Luther King. And I just wanted the world to know that he had more to say, you know. So I hope you guys got something out of, you know, the other America. And, you know, I played the song because, you know, I want everyone to remember, you know what I'm saying, you are beautiful no matter how they treat you, no matter what they say about you, anything, you know what I mean? I want the world to remember you are beautiful. Thank you guys for tuning in. Like I said at the top of the show, I just kind of wanted to hop on real quick and, you know, just do a little small broadcast on the celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King. I know his heart was full of compassion. You know, I say to you in the cosmos. And, yeah, guys, remember, you are beautiful no matter what they say. Peace and love.